Good morning and welcome to Want to Pick, the culture program of African Sisters Media Network. We are so honored today to have in a previous interview, Louisa Teach and Leilani Bailey, who are going to tell us about their new book on Holy Ground, Commitment and Devotion to Sacred Land. And before we start the interview, which was recorded yesterday at we're going to play a little music to sort of open the way. which piece I like to play, and I think I'm going to play Brilliant Sea from Gentle Warrior by Luke Gray.
Thank you.
So now I'd like to introduce our two guests. First, I'm going to start with Leilani Riley. I'm reading from her website, daughtersofthegoddess.com, and High Priestess Leilani. Leilani, Hawaiian Akahuna, ordained Dianic High Priestess and ceremonialist, brings ancient Hawaiian healing and goddess wisdom to the community. She is also on the faculty at Sophia University in Palo Alto. She has an MA in Women's Spirituality from New College of California, and she has a BS degree in Business and Finance from George Mason University. Louisa Teach is a writer, performance artist, and ritual events consultant. Her writing credits include several plays, Rice and Revolution, The Division of the Kauais, The Rise and Fall of Sam the Claus, or How the Claus Got Clipped, and Dear Women of Awol. She is also the author of several books on African and African-American spiritual culture. They include Jambalaya, the Natural Woman's Book of Personal Charms and Practical Rituals, a woman's spirituality classic, Carnival of the Spirit, Seasonal Celebration and Rites of Passage, Jump Up, Good Times Throughout the Seasons with Celebrations from Around the World, and What Don't Kill is Fattening Revisited, 20 Years of Poetry, Prose, and Myth. She has contributions to 13 anthologies and has written numerous movie, play, and book reviews. She has published articles and interviews in magazines such as Essence, Myth, Shaman's Drum, and the Yoga Journal. And again, I mentioned earlier that both Leilani and Yeye have collaborated on this wonderful work on Holy Ground, Commitment and Devotion to Sacred Lands, which just came out this year. And there are going to be several book readings that you'll be able to participate in and meet the authors, and they're also going to be hosting workshops and things like that to help people implement some of the various rituals and suggestions that are mentioned in the book. So let me play for you this wonderful interview that is certainly to be enlightening for all of us about this wonderful book. It's a wonderful read. It's not really long, but definitely gives some powerful information. And it's really great that these two healers have come together.
I want to thank both you, Louisa Teach, and Leilani, how do you pronounce your last name?
Byerly,
for joining me today to talk about your wonderful book on Holy Ground, Commitment and Devotion to Sacred Lands. And I just wanted both of you to just talk a little bit about how you came to know each other and to be doing this sacred walk and felt the need, you know, to write this book. I mean, your intro is just really wonderful. But I wonder if you could just basically take turns talking about how you came to know each other and how you came to write a book together.
Oh, my goodness. How we came to know each other. Well, let's see. There's probably stories that can be told and stories that can't be told.
Stories that shouldn't be told.
Well, I'd say I heard about Louisa Teach when I was in the Women's Spirituality Master's program, and I was directed to her by several people that said, you have to meet Teach. You have got to do ritual with Teach. You have to know this woman. And I was lucky enough to receive a copy of Jambalaya by tape, which I think is very tricky to get a hold of.
Yes.
And the minute I heard her voice, I said, who is this woman? I have to know her. This is a kindred soul. Get me to her. And I called you right away, and she picked up her phone, which I now know is a really rare occasion. And I think we've, in one way, shape, or form, been pretty much together and in collaboration ever since. So
about 20 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, from my point of view, those of you who have Jambalaya, you will see in the last chapter, I make the statement that in my attempt to understand the world, I await the arrival of my sister from the East. I put out a call asking that a woman that I could relate to who would help me to understand the culture would appear in my life. And that person is Leilani. It took me a long time to really understand the depth of my relationship to Pele because, for example, when I was in college in Oregon, I was at a little United Church of Christ school where there were maybe 1,100 students, 35 black students, and 200 Hawaiian students in Oregon, of all places. You'd never expect to find Hawaiians in Oregon. And then Pele showed up again the night that I was being initiated into Yoruba tradition. We have to take a bath in the river. And on the way to the river here in the Bay Area, my husband's car broke down, and we were trying to figure out how to get me to the river. So he goes out to the street, and he's flagging people down to see if we can get a ride. And a Hawaiian kahuna stopped, and he said, my wife is being initiated. We have to go to the river. And that's the person who helped me get to the river to start my initiation.
They took you to the river.
They took me to the river. Before my Yawo year was up.
That's an ocean.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I was called to the island of Maui to attend to the spirits of the forest when another woman was going through her womanhood rite. And then, you know, later on, at a point when I thought I was sick and tired of being a priestess, you know, I made the mistake of going to Pele and saying, you know, I'm tired of this. Please let me know if I can retire, right? And the volcano erupted. So I don't mess with Pele. I'm not playing no games with her. And so she appears to me in the form, she has come to me in the form of Leilani. And we work together, and it's just fantastic. It's amazing. So that's the perspective on this relationship.
Wow, sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing. Over a 20-year period, you know, it took me, 15 of them years to understand that Pele really is with me.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while.
Yeah. So how do you know? Who is Pele?
Pele.
Pele's the Hawaiian goddess of the volcano and fire. So when she's actually a deity that is very much known and revered and loved and feared and honored in the culture. So even through all of the different things that have happened with the Hawaiian culture, Pele is definitely someone that you hear about growing up as a Hawaiian child. And I think a lot of people that go to the islands feel a connection with the volcano and Pele. And when Tisha's saying that she understands that connection, it's understanding a lot about beauty, but also a lot about the tumultuous nature of life.
Yes.
And the huge transformative change, the kind of change where, you know, land is created, land is destroyed, drastic things can happen in a moment's notice. Yeah, so she's kind of, I guess, well, we call her Tutu Pele, which is like grandma. So she's Big Mama.
Big Mama.
Yeah.
Big Mama Pele, yeah. She's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, well, I know a little bit about you, and I learned more in the book, Leilani, and I know a little bit about you, and I learned more about you in the book as well. And what I know about both of you, because, Leilani, I met you at the Blessings of the Waters of the World, is that you dance.
Yeah.
And you make hula contemporary in your interpretive work. And I know of you, that you are a dancer as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, you sing, and I'm sure you probably sing, too. And
yeah.
And I was thinking that particular aspect of your friendship, before, you know, before you even came together, you were doing, you do the same kind of work as artists.
Yes. Right.
And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your work as artists and how that informs this particular book, because you talk about land being sacred, and you, Leilani, talk about being a girl of, you know, more than one culture and not fitting in when you're not in Hawaii. You know, you're not home because you're a brown girl, and you don't fit in. and you know, you love sort of being able to run free and be free. And you know, you also have a real tumultuous childhood.
Yep.
You know, and you also grew up in a small town where you're close to the planet, close to the earth. So, you know, it's like these through lines, sort of interesting how before you met each other, you were having similar kinds of experiences. So I guess that's another reason why you all have so much affinity for one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Well, that's very observant, because I would say that really pretty much describes a lot of our connection, you know, that there's a lot of things that we can talk about and share. That's what made the easy part of writing the book, is that we can sit down and talk and really understand where each other's coming from.
Absolutely.
And that we are kindred spirits.
Sure.
And there is a sisterhood there, even though I consider Tish my elder, a spiritual elder, but that we understand.
Yes.
You know, so that there's a foundation that we have where we can start communicating from a certain point,
right?
You know, which is, I think, very rare and unique, and one of the reasons why I think we've been drawn together and why we continue to stay together, you know?
Let me say this, that having a relationship to the earth and both being dancers and artists, we recognize that a lot of what's being taught in a lot of these schools that say they have spirituality programs is a disembodied, disconnected spirituality. And it's always been, you know, it's always been my job, as far as I was concerned, to take all of the intellectual blah blah and ground it in everyday reality, connect it to culture, make the people feel what is going on. And that is done through touching the earth and through moving energy through your body. So with both of us coming from that kind of artistic background, it was easy for us to understand that what's being taught in the schools has to be substantiated with indigenous ways of knowing and doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to heal that fragmentation that says mind is higher than spirit, or knowledge should be separated from experience. That does not make for a whole person, you know. So we both come from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then probably as you know, you reflect on your own childhood and the fragmentation of that.
Yeah.
You know, sort of separating the mind from the spirit, and also that you all were not able to be yourselves because the culture that you were reared in did not honor who you are. And that came, you know, sort of, I mean, you maintain who you are, but it was difficult because it was the fight. And you talk about that.
I think it remains, too. I think it still remains.
We're still fighting.
Yeah.
I'm still fighting Exxon and Monsanto. I mean, those are the culture that I had in New Orleans, in Louisiana, being close to the earth, being close to spirit. The conquistadors came in and destroyed the forest behind my house, which means that it fractured my psyche, you know, and that still goes on. Right now, I feel wounded because the tree in the backyard has had a great limbs have been severed off of that tree. I barely go out in the backyard anymore because I look at the tree, I see the place where the limb was cut, the branch was cut, and for me, I can hear the tree crying, and I see the tree bleeding where the resin is falling out. I'm not one of those people who can look at that and feel like me and the tree are so separate that I don't feel what it feels. I feel some of what that tree feels, and it oppresses me because now I don't hang out in the backyard the way I originally wanted to. And so this is an analogy in my, as far as I'm concerned, with what Eurocentric, male-dominated, fractured society does to people who are grounded in an indigenous culture.
I know that was interesting because I thought you were talking in the book about what happened in your backyard as a child, and then the exact same thing just happened a few months ago.
Yeah.
You know,
the one that took her away.
Yeah, I think my sister Tanya. Well, I was definitely not going to be here either.
Yeah.
So if I would have been here, we would have had to go someplace else.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how the things that we hold as sacred are seen as not a big deal. Like one of the things I've noticed, you know, we always say in Hawaii, the local people move into a home with, they want a lot of trees around.
Right.
Then, but other people come in, the first thing they do is cut everything down.
Yeah.
Not even just the trees, but the ferns.
Yeah.
You know,
when
we sold my grandma's house, there was a big monkey pod tree and a mango tree and, you know, ferns that had been there for 50 years, you know, it was like a fort. Yeah,
farm.
Yeah, and old plumerias.
Ooh.
And all sorts of tropical plants that you just don't get.
Right.
Unless you've had a garden for 30, 40, 50 years. And the first thing the new owners did was come in and cut all the plants down.
That's crazy.
And then put a swimming pool in where the monkey pot tree was.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
You know, even though the ocean's only a few blocks away.
Exactly.
Yeah, so just, you know, different philosophies and different ways. And then also that we want the trees for shade.
Yeah.
You know, so that helps to conserve energy.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a way that you work with the land.
That's right.
Instead of trying to dominate it and put your big fancy house with air conditioning and all this kind of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, as both of you were speaking, I sort of heard maternal instincts, you know, as you know, coming out. And you definitely, one feels the mother. The mother, the big mother, you know, the mother planet.
That's right.
And as well as the mother, that mothers that you both are, cause, and both of you all actually have daughters, too.
Yeah.
That's right.
And you write, and I love the part where you write about your daughter, you all taking a journey together. And
girls are beautiful. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And you talk a little bit about your daughter, not as much, but you talk about your mother, and I've heard about your daughter. So I was wondering if you could talk about that relationship, you know, as mothers sort of resonating with the big mother or the great mother, and how that came to be a reason for writing this book about ritual. Because this book is, you know, actually sort of a hands-on kind of book. You tell us to read it through quickly the first time. And also, I love your illustrations, your paintings. In the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it's like it's a work of art. I mean, it's so thin. You think, oh, yeah, I can read this fast. You can't really read it fast at all. And then, yeah, you got to go back through, okay, now, and then sort of like map it out. Okay, so what am I going to do first?
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do second?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so why don't you talk a little bit about, as you know, as a mother and resonating with, you know, the Earth Mother, and then talk more about sort of the way you all, well, you saw that there was a need for this because you saw people not knowing how to be in ceremony and how to observe without interfering, and how to know, well, this is not my place, I need to go.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to hear your reflections, you know, because we've been so close to it. It's wonderful to hear what other people have to say. And I think one of the things that we're definitely connected and that makes us have a common frame of reference is our devotion to the Mother Goddess.
Yes.
And our deep devotion and belief that there is female deity, and in Hawaiian we would say Akua Vahine, or female goddess or female deity, like Pele. We were talking about her being the fire goddess, and then Laka is the goddess of hula, so I feel connected to her. And I feel that raising daughters, but I also think for women that are raising sons, that the children do get a different and more expanded connection with the earth and to care for things, you know? Because I know with your girl, with Selena, who I've seen, who is also beautiful,
yes,
and amazing and powerful,
yes,
that there is an energy and a respect that they have,
yes,
especially being raised in this kind of environment and tradition and with these values, that there's a deeper understanding and that they get to hold a wisdom and knowledge for the next generation as well, and teaching folks. Because you think people are getting things just because they're younger, but they're not necessarily getting it if they're not taught.
Well, you know, I have to say that the book really came into being because of Leilani. I used to do sacred sites tours and thought that I was teaching people how to embrace the sacredness of the earth and our history, and, you know, going to a sacred site, especially where something has been built that has endured for centuries, you think that people would understand that our relationship to the earth is ancient and important and so on. But what happened to me is I was sponsoring sacred sites tours and encountering people who were on tour but didn't realize, or really, they weren't there for the sacredness, you know. So I'm taking some people to Jamaica to go to Milk River, this healing river, and they come with a case of wine and want to go to Rick's American Cafe and that kind of thing. And what really did it for me in terms of fracturing my spirit is I have a memory of being in Egypt and seeing a man put his cigarette out on the pyramids. Yeah, I mean, that talk about a wounding, I still can't process that, you know what I'm saying? It's still a shock for me. And so I got disgusted, and I just stopped doing sacred sites tours. So here comes Leilani, and she says, well, you know, Tish, that's not the right attitude. You have to understand that people don't understand that their relationship to the earth is wounded. And so we have to teach them. We have to make them understand. I said, so you know what, y'all, get out of my face. Yeah. Leave me alone. I'm done.
Too bad.
Too bad, right? You know what I'm saying? You know, because I was undone. And then we sat down and we talked about it and realized the important thing was to make people understand that they had been miseducated into conquistador consciousness, you see. So I've had in my lifetime, because I counsel people spiritually, I had a young white boy who came to me who was having all kinds of crazy experiences, strange dreams, stuff happening to him. And as I'm talking to him, it turned out he had been in Africa, had gone to somebody's shrine, had taken a sacred vessel off of their shrine and brought it here, and then started having all these crazy things happening to him, just like the people who sacked the pyramids, you know. They let loose an energy that they can't handle. And when I realized that he had stolen something from somebody's altar, okay, I said, I need you to understand, what made you think you could do that?
Yeah.
What, you know, I want you to meditate on it, and I want you to answer me. I want you to think about it. And what he came back with was, as a child, he had gone to a lot of museums, and he knew that the things in the museum were stolen, and so he thought it was all right to steal.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
The museums taught him
that stealing is all right.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
All the things in the museum are stolen.
All of the things in the museum are stolen, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that example made me get in accord with Leilani and say, okay, people don't understand they need to be re-educated, and that's why an important part of the book is a section called Overcoming Conquistador Consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Overcoming it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, because it's very internalized.
It's internalized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what Tisha's talking about, that I like to try and take the perspective that people aren't intentionally doing things,
mm-hmm.
We would hope.
We would hope.
And that if they were given the information, that they perhaps would make different choices. Because
yes.
I think the thing that's unique about Tish and myself is that not a lot of the elders of indigenous and native traditions are willing to sit down.
Mm-hmm.
People have actually lost their patience, or they haven't been heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a reluctance in many cultures.
Exploited.
Or they've been exploited, or was the knowledge was taken and then it was written in a book or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about the people that take copious notes and then the next thing you know,
they're writing a book on the subject.
Yeah.
They don't get credit.
Yes.
Get
no credit where credit is due. So I think people are feeling protective. So, and I think for good reason. So I think that everything that we've shared feels like, you know, actually a lot of basic information that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then for those willing to learn more, you know, that'll be the On Holy Ground too, I think. Because, and actually what Tish didn't mention about this book is it also, this book was a chapter in another book that we started.
Yeah.
So we actually have been working on another book, and then this piece.
Yeah, this is one chapter.
Wanted to be addressed.
Six chapter outline.
Yeah.
You know. So I think the things that are unique about this book, we wrote it in two voices. Okay. What's really, really important.
They're really distinctive too.
Yeah.
I know when I'm reading you, and I know when I'm reading you. There's no blurring.
Okay. No blurring,
Although you compliment one another.
Yeah.
It's clear, you know what I'm saying? The other thing that's important to know about this book is that not only did we write, the people we quoted, we wrote them not only asking for permission to quote them, whether we needed it legally or not, but we also asked for their blessing to have quoted them. And that's a difference from the arrogance that sometimes appears where people are writing, they just quote people and sometimes paraphrase them and don't even give them credit.
Mm-hmm.
I think a special feature is the chart where there's a comparison between the African and the Hawaiian deities,
mm-hmm.
and their places in nature with an explanation of the power of that place with recommendations for rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the book, we ask people to take an oath to love the earth and to take care of the earth. And I take that very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
serious. Yeah, I know you do.
Yeah.
That and in taking care of the children.
Absolutely.
Protecting the children.
You got to protect the children.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
have to. How, for me, people talk about institutions dehumanizing you. I say as long as you can care for your elders, protect your children, and honor your dead, no matter how broke you are or whatever, you still have the rights of a human. When somebody starts to take that from you, then they're trying to turn you into an animal.
Mm-hmm.
Even elephants have a graveyard, okay? Alligators take care of their young, you know. Herds of buffalo know who the elders are. But there is a way in which conquistador culture, which we were talking about at the kitchen table, comes in, and whatever people have set up for the nurturing of the group, they fragment that. They destroy that in order to destroy the people. And so in many cultures where the work of woman was what the mothering was what held, you know, everything together. The first thing you do is you come in and you disempower the women, you destroy the ceremonies, you demonize the deities. That's part of the oppression formula.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Leilani, did you have a comment? Or?
I like the icon.
Okay, great. Yeah, I really like that section where you talked about Gore.
Woo!
Yeah, and because I didn't have that experience in Gore.
Oh, what was it like for you?
I didn't feel anything because there were too many white people there.
Okay.
And the guys were catering to those people,
mm-hmm.
and they were speaking in French, so I didn't understand what they were talking about because they didn't even come to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like. So my little guide, his English wasn't as good as his French, so he told me it was my friend. My friend's grandson went with me, and he was like 14. So we explored it together, and he translated where he had the ability, the linguistic ability, but a lot of it I just sort of just looked at the things. But when I went to Jufre, where Alex Haley's people are.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, I felt that.
Because
the island is sinking into the ocean.
Wow.
Yeah, and there was like baobab trees, and they were in fruit, so you could actually eat the... It felt like eating a cloud. The texture of the fruit. And so that's what I remember when I think about...
Have you written about it?
I don't know.
Girl, you got to write about it so that we can share it.
Was that on the same trip, the two places that you went to?
Let's see. I'm trying to think. Was it on... Well, it was on one of the trips when I went to Senegal that I went to Gambia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not certain if it was... I don't know. It wasn't the first time I went.
What a contrast, though.
But, yeah, that particular part, that was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Yeah, that was. They said you feel too much.
I was like,
yeah. Let me talk a little bit about that, and then you pay a lot of attention to the natural cycles. You know, the moon, the tides. We just had an equinox. One of you could talk about how that impacts ritual, and then the sacred zones, and. The sacred zones.
The spirits are here.
The spirits are here.
Yeah, they're definitely here.
Well, as soon as you said Gory Island.
Yeah, saw it.
Yeah. So I want you to talk a little bit about those particular aspects of the book. And then I wanted to ask each of you to read a section of your choice for the audience so they can get a feel for the language and the musicality and the poetry of the work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, Gore Island. In this book, we have Tisha's first journey to Africa. And as an African-American, you know, we go through being raised, told, you ain't African, and then living through finding out you are African, and then being very proud of being African and having all kinds of ideas about what Africa must be like. Then comes the reality for me of actually landing in Dakar and all of the things that happened to me in the book, the vultures in my window, the cab driver who's not really a cab driver. Some of it was like the opening to a grade B movie. But the trip to Gore Island, was really, really profound for me. I was lucky enough not to have the situation you had, Wanda, but to have an intimate situation with a guide who knew the history and who was attentive to me. Being there and stepping through that last door, knowing that that was the door that so many of us stepped through to get on those boats to come over here, I feel like I had what some would call a past life experience. You know, for me, I remember being there. For me, I could still smell the blood. You know, there were things that happened there, and the energy was still there. We performed a ritual on the other side of the door, asking that in the history of human beings, let there never be another trafficking
like that coming through these doors ever again. And in fact, there are a lot of people who over the past 20 years have gone to different slave ports, both in Africa and in Europe, America, and South America, and sealed those doors so that we never have that kind of trade again. Now, unfortunately, there is sex trafficking that is going on, which is slavery. You know, it's just slightly different, but only slightly. And so I'm putting energy to shut that down, too. But the thing about Gori that is really interesting is that conquistador culture, what it often does is it takes a place where a historical injustice has occurred and turn it into a casino. Turn it into a gambling house. Turn it into a place where they want to cover up the oppression by saying, oh, it was just a game of chance, or, you know, this is a place of happenstance. And I understand that that's what's happening to Gori these days, mm-hmm. is that it's becoming a casino. Now, I do know someone whose son is fighting to have a historical museum established on Gori, and I would much prefer that over the casino thing. But the energy of what happened there is still there.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to see the women's museum? Might not have been there yet. There's a women's museum there.
Yeah, I
had. At Gore. Wow, a casino. That's,
yeah.
Oh, that's horrible. Yeah. And also wanted to mention with regards to sexual trafficking,
mm-hmm.
and we're sitting in the epicenter right now,
yeah.
in Oakland, California, mm-hmm. that the play that I mentioned to you, 52 Letters,
mm-hmm.
that was a part of the
mm-hmm.
San Francisco Fringe Festival. This year, I think it's 22nd annual or something like that. She won Best of Fringe, Regina Evans.
Right on.
So people are really aware of this. I saw people weeping in the performance. It's just 1 hour long, 1 hour.
Intense.
Very, very, very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be coming back in November, so maybe you can catch it then.
It sounds like something you have to prepare yourself emotionally.
And I told her, and she said that she's going to actually have some alters, because there's no way to clear that.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just hit all this, and then we're hit again with somebody that's working in slavery abolition around,
uh-huh.
you know. But that's still the same thing.
Yeah, people's
yeah.
auras need to be clean
yeah.
after bringing up that kind of
thing. Yeah, you walk out into the street and it's Skid Row.
Yeah, oh!
So then you see you're on Eddie.
Oh!
Eddie, between Taylor and Market.
Ooh.
Or Taylor and whatever that other street is. And so you're walking into a situation where the people who you're seeing on the street
mm-hmm. are the people in
the people in the play
mm-hmm.
older.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this might be why they're there.
Yep,
now.
Gotcha.
Both
yeah.
men and women, and
gotcha.
It's just really dismal.
It's dismal.
Wow.
Well, that's like Rabbit Proof Fence.
Yeah, we're just talking about that. I just finally saw that movie. Yeah, I told Atish, someone said that Atish should not see it by herself. But I thought it was one of those movies that I'm going to probably use as a teaching tool make my family watch it, or whoever, friends. Because that was, there's so many parallel stories, you know, about the same thing over and over again. And it's interesting because I noticed that, you know, there's this combination of people wanting to knowing the truth, but knowing the truth is not always something that feels fuzzy
mm-hmm.
and like a nice white crystal light
mm-hmm.
floating through your soul, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really for people who, you know, are really willing to dig deep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of what our work is about too,
yeah.
and this book,
yeah.
to get people to start thinking about things.
Yeah.
You know, like, because of course Hawaii's a place where everybody has their perfect, pleasant holiday, fantasy, honeymoon, this and that. But that there are things to go to, you know, that are tell you about the Hawaiian history of the Iolani Palace.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was really something when you talk about that.
Yeah, going
that,
to the...
That was like glory for you.
Yeah, very much so, because you feel the energy of the place. And I'm always amazed about the difference, because, you know, you go to these things, and of course there's a certain amount of tourists, and they do kind of... gear the discussion depending on who's on the tour.
Because
I've taken groups on the tour, or when I went with my hula halau, you know, they know that we're able to hear the full-blown thing. But I get that there's the need to balance, you know, somebody that may not have even known what happened.
Right.
And then it gets a little bit toned down, you know.
It's toned down a lot.
And there's an energy there, you know, and it's like, when are we going to be able to move into a place where we can really address these things? You were talking about the schools earlier. You know, that I think it sometimes is challenging to be a teacher where women want to learn about spirituality and ritual and ceremony and indigenous ways, but then once you start crossing into that realm and making it more embodied and making it more ceremonial, you know, either the students sometimes have a difficult receiving it, or you're told, you know, from the institution, you know, that boundaries are being crossed and this shouldn't be done, or this should be done, or you can only do it this way, or you can only do it that way. And I've actually even been to, you mentioned in the book about a camp you went to. I've been to actual camps and been, you know, invited and hired as a presenter. And then once I get there, people are saying, oh, no, you can't use this and you can't do, you know, the things that, the things that I would feel are necessary to help cleanse. Like you're talking about doing these more intensive types of experiences. You bring people through a process. There need to be remedies and healing tools and things that we do in order to help facilitate that. And then you're hearing, you know, well, this one's allergic to that, and this one's getting a headache over that. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting place to be. So I think we're always trying to ride that line, you know, to kind of have a cutting edge place where we can go as close to the edge while still being allowed to do what we want to do and not compromise things. And there are times where I feel like I'm asked to compromise what I would do so much that I actually don't feel like I have permission from my own ancestors or my elders to go there because it would really not be what I do.
Right.
You know, so I think that's for coming up at this time around this.
Yeah.
So do you want to choose something to share?
Oh, my goodness.
I can hold this for you.
Okay. Whoa. All right. What on earth would I want to... read from here. Well, we talked about Goree already, so I think I'll go past or lead up to.
So, what do the vultures represent? Because you said the vultures were
were
the symbol for a particular deity.
For Oshun, for my deity, for Oshuni Bukole.
And you have a yellow.
That's right.
You have
this is okay. I'll just read that little piece. Okay. Air France flight number who knows what landed at the airport in Dakar, Senegal, in the spring of 1989. It was the first time I would set foot on African soil. It was the hope of a lifetime manifested. I was traveling with a small party. There were five of us, three men and two women, myself and my goddaughter, Uzuri Amini. We'd come to Africa with clear purpose, high hopes, and open hearts. As this story unfolds, I will refrain from naming the three men because I no longer have relationships with them. For decades, I'd envisioned what this moment would look and feel like. I would walk out of the airport into the lush green of my mother continent, accompanied by the throbbing of djembe drums and beautiful people laughing, dancing funga lafia, and offering me deliciously spiced food locally grown. In my vision, I would step out onto the land, come down on my knees, and kiss the holy ground before I accepted any of these wonderful gifts. That had been the dream. The reality was shockingly different. In reality, my first major accomplishment was surviving the ordeal of customs. The airport was littered with soldiers carrying M16 rifles that they used to rummage through my luggage. we managed to pay off the appropriate parties and were ushered out of the airport and into the open air. I remember a feeling of fear and repulsion overtaking me as I stepped outside. Instead of the throbbing drums and beautiful dances of my vision, I was greeted with the smell of decaying flesh and the roar of confusion in another language. The sidewalk was lined three rows deep with lepers whose bodies were covered in khaki-colored rags and whose faces were covered in sores. As they stretched out their hands, I saw that many of them had fingers missing. It is a Muslim custom to chop off a knuckle each time a person is caught stealing. Some of these hands were so severely butchered that working or stealing was out of the question. The only thing they could do was beg. I changed my American dollars for Cine francs in the airport and pressed the money into as many palms as I could while walking quickly toward a car whose driver signaled us forward and who cautioned me not to give them money, madame. The members of my party and I piled into two cars, named our hotel, and began arguing with the drivers about the final cost of the fare. The driver of my car sped off and maintained a speed of about 90 miles per hour. He drove straight through a marketplace and sent fruit and feathers flying. He almost hit two vendors. I thought this was the opening to a poorly directed adventure movie. We arrived at our hotel, the Novotel Dakar. I had to bribe the driver into helping me bring the luggage into the hotel lobby. He brought my bags in, dropped them on the floor, collected his money, and ran out the door. The concierge, a black man, walked to the door, looked, and came back to me, and he said, "That man was your driver?" "Yes," I answered him. "You paid him?" I said, "Yes." Then he said, "That man is no driver, and the car you rode in was stolen at the airport." Before I could react, he handed me a key and said, "Welcome to Senegal, madame." Well, I'd blown the whole kiss the holy ground scene of my vision. Now all I wanted to do was go to my room, take off my clothes, and wash the scent of lepers off of me. Although one of the men was my husband, we found it more economical to get two rooms, one for the men and one for the two women. Uzuri and I walked into our room and dropped the suitcases on the floor. It was hot and stuffy inside, and I sorely needed some fresh air. I walked over to the window with the intention of opening it, but just as I stepped up to it, a large black bird, a vulture, slammed itself against the window pane. I screamed and stepped back from the window. Then I stripped naked, went into the bathroom, and scrubbed my body vigorously. When I came out of the shower, I threw myself on the bed and cried myself to sleep. I did not know it then, but the presence of the vulture was an important omen. Several years earlier, I had been initiated as a priestess of Oshuni Bukole, whose animal totem is the African vulture. I wasn't thinking of that then. I was just in shock. But I realize now that the vulture is also the Sankofa bird, who comes to remind us to fetch the ways of the ancestors and bring them into the future. I soon came to understand that the Sankofa bird in my window was a foreshadowing of my coming to visit to Gori Island, one of the last doors that many slaves passed through leaving Africa.
Mm-hmm. No matter how many times I hear that, still,
I know.
If I might need my glasses sometimes. The community glasses.
Mm-hmm. So when is your other book coming out that this is a chapter of? And are you going to put this back in that book and we'll have it twice?
Huh. We don't know yet, huh?
I know. That's a good point. It's interesting because you'll think you're going to do certain things,
mm-hmm.
and then other things happen,
yeah.
Right? We were talking about how Tisha always told me that you don't write the book writes you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, well, we talked about Pele, so maybe we'll talk about her.
Okay.
Pele, dancing for fire. A Pele, A Pele, A, sweet flowing Mother Earth.
hot molten lava, bringer of new earth and destroyer of old. Share your passion, your commitment, and courage to dance and speak the fire of sacred truth. Fire is truth, fire is passion, fire is creativity. Light a candle in her name and ask for all of these attributes. Go outdoors or stand in front of a mirror. Gently swing your hips side to side, breathing in the life force, the fire of life. Allow the spine to open up, the pelvis and the lower back. Feel the flow of the earth's energy rise up through your feet, into your calves, knees, thighs, hips, spine, belly, organs, chest, heart, shoulders, throat, head, face, spreading out the arms and fingertips. Feel the healing beat of the earth's core warm your body and soul. If your eyes have been closed, open them and look into the flame of your candle. Let a soft gaze rest upon the light and speak your truths out loud or silently. Ask for those things you want to draw strength upon and call into your life, and those things that no longer serve you that you would like to release. Reach your hands to the sky, waving them side to side, feeling that you are dancing and fanning the fire of your desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like what I did for the equinox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. you take the things you don't need or
you've
outgrown and you give them back.
That's right.
Definitely.
Let it go.
Make room for the new growth.
Make room for the new growth.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want people to know that we are going to be doing sacred sites tours again.
Okay.
And that for each tour, we will have a workshop to orient you to the indigenous ways of the place we're going. The first tour is scheduled for March for Bali.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And there we'll be participating in the ritual to clean away negativity.
Mm.
Okay, it's a big, beautiful festival where you make bamboo statues of whatever the evil is, and it's paraded through the street and then burned, and then everybody bathes and goes into a period of meditation. So I'm going to be doing that. It'll be on the website and on Facebook soon. And I'm also working on a possibility for Costa Rica and South Africa.
Hmm.
So 2014, get your passports in order, people.
Definitely. And we still
saving.
Are having parties in the Bay Area as well, and I know we have an upcoming one Wednesday, October 30th at Napa Valley
College.
Community College.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Yeah, so we'll be there that evening from 6 to 9.
From 6 to 9.
Yes.
And then we're hoping to be able to participate in First Friday in Oakland, the first Friday in December.
Yes.
And in between, we're still looking for a location for the November workshop.
Yes.
So
okay.
We really want to help people overcome the alienation that they've been taught. And, you know, I want people to travel with us knowing that they are on sacred mission and that they are safe and connecting to the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's the website? You mentioned the website for information about the dates of these upcoming workshops for 2014, as well as any other book events or the workshop that you don't have space designated for presently, but you will eventually. So how do people stay in touch?
Well, I have two websites and you have one. For me, you can go to www.luisateish.com, luisateish.com. You can also go to www.ileounimilaoshun.com. Ile Orumila Oshun.
The first one will tell you all of the services that I provide and the books that I recommend and so on and so forth. The second one, ileorumilaoshun.com, will list all the public rituals and travel events. It's the place where my public activities calendar is.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you go to www.daughtersofthegoddess.com, mm-hmm. you can find more information about what we're doing as well as order the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope to see you soon or,
mm-hmm.
and hear from you.
Yeah.
And maybe be on tour.
Be
Bali.
On tour. Come go to Bali.
Hawaii. We're thinking of going to New
Hawaii,
Orleans.
Hawaii, yes.
Oh, for the Voodoo Festival.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
you know,
yeah.
Oh, you mean like next
year? Well,
next year.
Yeah, fall of 2014. We've been talking about that. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that was
cool. We got a whole bunch of things going on.
Yeah.
Lots of things brewing in the cauldron.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thank both of you so much for joining us today to talk about On Holy Ground commitment and devotion to sacred land. Thank you so much for joining us and looking forward to having you on again and to visiting you attending one of these workshops and certainly accompanying you on, if not all, a lot of these tours.
Yes, baby.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just...
Well, that was a wonderful interview, and all that scratching was the microphone. I didn't realize it was as sensitive as it is. I wanted to play something from, I think there's actually a piece that I've got, Take Me to the Waters, and I wanted to play that. But in the meantime, I'm going to play Abraham Burton's Amina. Well, actually, no. Amina. Or Nebulae, which one? I think I will play Amina, and then I will shift into this other piece. Gosh, choices. I think I will play Nebulae. I really like that piece by Abraham Burton. Well, that was Abraham Burton's Nebulae. And we're going to close the show with Dwight Tribble's rendition of Langston Hughes' poem, I've Known Rivers. And this is for our guests, Louisa T. and Leilani Abirley, both traditional healers and and leaders in the community, and I want to congratulate them on their book, their collaboration on Holy Ground, Commitment and Devotion to Sacred Lands.
Bosom turn all gold in the sunset.